We're with astronaut and author Chris Hadfield. We're going to take calls with Chris this hour on Coast to Coast when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with astronaut Chris Hadfield. Chris, the ISS is up 200 plus miles. What does planet Earth look like from the International Space Station? How big? How small?
It fills half of your view. And it's sort of, if you could imagine, you've probably looked at, down the pipe of a kaleidoscope. If you could imagine a kaleidoscope that filled half of everything that you could see, and it was bulging towards you and constantly changing in like a kaleidoscope does, in the textures and the colors and the shadows and all of that. That's what it's like. It is mesmerizing and silent and separate from you, like this enormous, distracting, beautiful, silent thing. It's the favorite pastime of all astronauts, just to try and understand our world and see it better.
Is 200 miles plus enough to look at the entire globe of the Earth, or you only see a portion of it?
No, you only see a portion of it. And the space station, we jack our orbit up and down. We fire the engines on the space station every so often to push our orbit up a little higher. But yeah, we're only, if you took a globe, like a standard school globe, and you just put your eye like an inch or two above the globe, that's how much of the world you see, because that's kind of how close you are. So like overhead of St. Louis, you can see L.A., just on the horizon, and the other way you can see, you can't see all the way to the East Coast, but you can see a large part of the U.S. You can see all the Great Lakes in a glance, or all of Europe in a glance. When you're overhead London, you can see Rome and Stockholm. You see a lot of it, but you don't see the whole ball.
Where can people get the Apollo Murders?
Everywhere. Obviously, anywhere you buy a book, little independent bookstores, on the big book chains, you can get an order online, Amazon, anywhere that you get a book. It's already in 13 languages, in fact, and all over the world. So, yeah, if just put it in wherever you buy books, and the Apollo Murders is there, I'm pretty confident.
Is there a number three on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm actually writing the next book in the series. There's been so much interest in the Apollo Murders that I'm already contracted with three different publishers to write the next one. And I've already been traveling to do the research for the next one. It takes place in a couple different places around the world. So, yeah, when you read the Apollo Murders, that won't be the last time you see those characters.
Is there a character star in the book?
Yeah, there are two, I think, George. One is a Navy test pilot who had an accident. And so he can no longer be an astronaut, but it puts him in a great position because he has all the skills, but he can't actually go do it. And his name is Kaz Zemeckis. And then the other one, and I didn't even know that this character was going to be in the book when I started writing the Apollo Murders, is a cosmonaut, a female cosmonaut named Svetlana Gromova. And she turned out to be just a really interesting character as I wrote the book. And I'm working hard to figure out a credible and interesting way for her to be in the next book in the series as well. But anybody who reads the book, they'll know that Svetlana is a badass of a character.
I see Angelina Jolie as playing her part.
Yeah, maybe.
Let's go to the phones. They're lining up for you. We'll start with Norman in St. Louis. Welcome to the show. Hi, Norman.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to tell the guest, I'm really proud of him and happy he was kind of able to do what he did in life and fulfill those purposes.
Well, thank you.
With all this bad stuff going on, it's nice to hear stories of people that, had an impact on the world and whatnot. But my question was, I just was curious because he mentioned he would have taken that 4-year trip to Mars. And I guess it's like, I wanted to know if he was married and had kids, because it seems like I would miss, I was married and had two sons and a granddaughter. I would just miss them too much. But I take my hat off to hockey players and sports people and whatnot that, they got to do what they got to do to, do what they do.
Travel around.
And they're missing their family. And then second was, did he ever have a fear? My biggest fear, say, being an astronaut, be up there and something happened and you just kind of drift off to nowhere.
Okay, let's take that one first, Chris. Have you ever been scared up there?
Yeah, Norman, thanks. I had lots of danger. Like one day when I was commanding the International Space Station, our main coolant, the liquid ammonia that cools the space station, started spraying out into space. And we had to do an emergency spacewalk to go and fix an ammonia leak. And ammonia's nasty stuff. Or another time, the whole the space station, the computers that run the whole thing started overwriting their own hard drives, and the whole space station went out of control. So those things happen. But you don't have to be just afraid unless you don't know what you're doing. And that's why we have professional astronauts, because I train for 21 years so that I wouldn't just be afraid, so I can handle those things. And so even though bad things happen, if you get ready for them, if you have the skills, you know, then you don't just have fear going for you. And I would much rather feel ready than feel afraid. You know, and then for Norman's first question, leaving your family, you know, you leave your, if you're a working person, you leave your family every day, right? And
but you come home most of the time.
You come home, but you need to sort of tally up, you know, how many hours and what are you doing and what do you bring to the family? And something my wife told me, we've been together since high school, something she told me a long time ago is giving up on your dreams doesn't come for free either. And if you say, well, you know, I would really love to do this in my life, but because I have a family, therefore I won't or I can't, you know, that's not just a perfect, easy trade. You've got to either somehow learn to live with that or not. And if it's a burr under your saddle for your whole life, then, you know, that can be bad for your relationship also. And so I think it's important to have that conversation with your spouse and with your kids and try and find the middle ground that works for everybody. You know, Navy, people that serve in the Navy spend an awful lot of time away from home, and some marriages do great and some don't. And I think expectation and respecting each other's pursuit of what is important to them, to me, that's really foundational.
Well, there's no doubt about that, and it's conceivable as well. Will you think NASA may select its astronauts for a Mars mission to be people who are single or might not have family?
It's a good question. They sure have thought about it for years. We've already started choosing the crews that are going to be going back to the moon here shortly and start settling on the moon. But the moon's only 3 days away. So, you know, it's
That's right.
like a long, complex business trip. But when you're going to Mars, then should we send just single people, or maybe should we send married couples? You know, because they're married astronaut couples, or
that's intriguing.
You know, we've got to kind of rethink it and look at the right psychology for a crew like that. We really and the right skill set, and we won't get it right, you know, but we need to try and get it as right as we can.
What happens to the first baby born on Mars, huh?
That's a real question, because we don't even know if an infant can develop properly without the stress of Earth's gravity. You know, your muscles and your bone density and all of the little balance systems, maybe Mars gravity, which is like 38% of Earth's gravity, maybe that's enough for a human body to develop normally. But the moon is only 1/6 of gravity, of Earth's gravity, and weightlessness. I mean, if a baby was born and raised in weightlessness, you know, how would it physiologically develop?
Good
like,
point.
It could maybe it could never come back to Earth. So that's some of the problems, you know, we need to think about as our technology gets better.
How long is an astronaut in space when their vision starts to have that effect that you were talking about?
It happens. It didn't happen during the shuttle era when our flights were just 2 or 3 weeks long. But typically on the space station, we found, you know, there's a period of training and adaptation and then a time where you're super productive. And then after a time, it's like you get a little bit cabin feverish and it's time to come home and we need to spread the experience around. So we've settled on 6 months as a good rotation time for space station crews. And so somewhere in the, you know, after 1 month and before 6 months, we don't really know the answer to your question, George. And so up on the space station, we have tonometers to measure your eyeball pressure, and we have those scopes that stare into the back of your eye and We do optic ultrasounds, like, you know, you put a ball of water on them and you do an ultrasound in order to image the whole eye, because we're trying to understand that, not only for astronauts, but it teaches us about just how the eye and the optic nerve and everything, how that all functions anyway. So it's quite interesting to the medical field, just the stuff we're studying and learning up there.
How many astronauts since we started going up to the ISS have been up there? What do you think?
I'm not sure exactly how many have been to the space station. We just went over 600 total of people who have flown in space just very recently. But that have lived on the space station, you know, it's in the low hundreds, maybe a couple hundred. And that's the number that have spacewalked as well. It's like the most unique human qualification, I think. There have been way more people have won Nobel Prizes than have walked in space. So it's still a pretty tiny little subgroup of humanity.
Is the vision situation, in some cases, you said it's temporary, some permanent? I mean, have some astronauts literally gone blind because of this?
Not blind. It's just like as you get older and your prescription changes, you know, or you might need to get bifocals,
sure,
reading glasses.
Every
it's
year
sort
it
of
changes.
Like that. And we actually have these interesting glasses on the space station. It's like two sheets of plastic with oil trapped between them. And by sliding this little bar, you can shape those pieces of plastic. So it's sort of like infinitely adjustable glasses. And they're ugly. You know, we call them birth control glasses, but they're ugly glasses. But they allow you, as your vision degrades over the 6 months up there, if it does, you can put these glasses on, and then it allows you to, you know, to get optimum vision. So, but it's not everybody, and that gets a degradation of vision, and we're thinking it might be a genetic thing. Wow. You know, some people are predisposed to it, and so it may just be one more reason why you might not get selected as an astronaut, because you've got a genetic predisposition to having this vision change.
Thomas in La Jolla, California. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for accepting
you.
My call. Chris, your courage is undeniable, and your dedication is also undeniable. I thank
Thanks,
you
Tom.
For your service, sir, and a comment and then a question. And I can't help but think about space over the last 50, 60 years as a cost overrun. Okay. And I'm looking at, this is a friendly comment here, but I look upon space and NASA as coast to coast guest and physicist James McCanney says, I often think that NASA, NASA, stands for never a straight answer. And as a taxpayer, that concerns me, Chris. And I'll give you an example. A while back, it was reported on the news media that it would cost $23 million to change the toilet in the International Space Station, okay? And I scratched my head because at the same time, I had to change the toilet where I worked, you know, where I lived, and cost $100 at the hardware store, another couple of $100 for a handyman to come in and install it, that type of thing. And I keep thinking of, from a taxpayer perspective, Chris, cost overruns. And going back to Apollo, Mercury, Gemini, you know, that type of thing. And I feel as a taxpayer, what did we get out of that? You know, maybe a synthetic orange juice called Tang. Remember Tang? Or Velcro, you know, that type of thing. But nothing really tangible. And so, again, this is the friendly question to you. I'm sure you see space exploration as productive for the human race. But again, I have to go back to the taxpayer perspective, which is, what's in it for us? When are we going to get straight answers?
How about right now, Tom? It's a question, you know, I served in the military for 25 years, and I was an astronaut for 21 years. And that's a question I ask myself at least once a week. Am I actually giving the taxpayer what they pay for? Because obviously my time in the military, we spend far more on the military than we do on NASA and space exploration. And the public trust is huge in our minds as combat pilots and as astronauts. And Tang, I mean, that's a private company, and we haven't flown Tang in space since the Gemini program, because it doesn't taste all that great going down, and it tastes even worse coming back up. So, that's just a marketing thing. But when you say nothing tangible, that's just a demonstration of your own ignorance, Tom. If you just do the research and go to NASA spinoffs, then you can see the list of hundreds and thousands of technologies that are used that came directly from the space program, and it's way too long for me to list. But one of the early ones, when you're talking the Apollo program, was called Nastran, which was one of the early great optimization software programs for weight, so that you could build something that was strong and light. And that technology that was developed for the launch gantry and for the launch vehicles and the spaceships was used for everything in American construction, in car design, to make cars strong and light. Or you can look at in the medical side, little optic sensors when one of your family wants to have their temperature taken, and they stick that thing in your ear and get your temperature in 1 second. You know, that's a direct application. There's thousands of them. But there's another side to it for the taxpayer, Tom, and that is what inspires our kids to do more things than we did. And there are lots of direct applications and understanding and inventions, but you also need to inspire people. And the people that are designing and building your cars, they're inspired by what's going on and exploring the rest of the universe. If you look at the two wealthiest people in the U.S., it's Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. They didn't want to be a delivery guy and the person who invented PayPal. They were inspired to create all of that wealth, to generate all those new technologies that we sort of take for granted now, because they were inspired as kids by the whole idea of spaceflight. So there's that side of it. And then maybe the third piece is how you use space technology every day. I mean, us talking to each other, you're in La Jolla, I'm in Toronto, and I think the producer of the show is in LA and George is in St. Louis or something like that. And we just take that for granted. What's the weather going to be like next week in La Jolla or somewhere? How we understand the world's weather, that comes from satellites. The global positioning system, I mean, imagine where we would be without that. And companies like Planet and the history of the whole world itself and how the climate is actually doing. How do we separate man-made effects from natural effects if we can't measure the whole world? So all of those things come from spaceflight. And this recent mission, I know that you were talking about it here on Coast to Coast recently, but the DART mission, which is going to figure out a way for us to deflect asteroids that have wiped out life on Earth in the past, we've never been able to do that in history up until very recently. Our technology is good enough that maybe we could protect the whole planet from a big asteroid. So I think you need to weigh all of those things together before you throw out, the baby with the bathwater.
We're going to take a break here, Chris, and come back with final calls in a moment. The name of the book, of course, is called The Apollo Murders. It's out there and available right now. We'll be back with astronaut Chris Hadfield, the Apollo Murders author, in just a moment with final calls on Coast to Coast. Next hour, Mark Lerner, the astrologer, joins us to tell us what's in store for next year, 2022, and also he will take readings in the last hour of the program. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie back with our final segment with Chris Hadfield. His book is called The Apollo Murders, available all over the place. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. Chris, these orbital debris particles, can they pierce the ISS?
George, if you were floating weightless next to the hull, like at nighttime on the space station, and you wait a while, you can actually hear orbital debris hit the armor on the outside of the space station, like a little ping or a little crack or a little ricochet. And when you go outside on a spacewalk, there are little pitted scars, like it's been, like a shotgun's been fired at it over and over and over again. So yeah, the space station gets hit all the time, but we built it knowing that's the environment it was going to be in. And up to a certain size, even though they're going super fast, going, you know, whatever, many miles a second relative speed, the space station's armor is enough to protect it, so unless they get too big.
Gosh, that's unbelievable. And the debris is traveling how fast, do you know?
Well, the space station is going 5 miles a second, 17,500 miles an hour. So it kind of depends which direction the debris is going. Like, you know, if it's like two hula hoops, right? If the space station's going sort of around the world and another one's going from the North Pole to the South Pole, it might hit you at almost 90 degrees. Or if it's natural debris, like rock from the universe, it could be going, you know, 20 miles a second and coming at you head on. And so the little piece, and the Earth gets hit by about 40 tons of rock every day, naturally occurring little bits of dust and little sand-sized grains and things. 40 tons a day hits the world just from the universe. So it's not a free and easy environment up there. And we practice for a puncture and a rapid depressurization of the space station. We practice for that all the time just in case or when it eventually happens.
Let's go to final calls. First-time caller Laura in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hello, Laura.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's
sure.
A very interesting show. And the reason why I'm calling is about the satellites and International Space Station. It's destroying planet Earth's atmosphere, which caused COVID-19 and fires and destruction.
Now, how do you say that? Why? How? What makes you say that?
The atmosphere protects planet Earth from outer space, from disease and destruction. And every time Cape Canaveral is in outer space, it destroys the atmosphere, which causes disease and destruction.
Oh, all right. Well, let's go to the astronaut. I don't think the ISS or satellites have any influence of the atmosphere, Chris.
Laura, just before the pandemic, in the year 2018, there were about 40 million commercial airline flights. 40 million. So you can do the math how many a day that was. There were 112 space launches. So, you know, 40 million commercial airline flights versus 112 space launches. So just the size of the number shows what a pipsqueak of a problem it is or of an impact it might have compared to everything else we do in our atmosphere, not to mention the hundreds of millions of cars that are, you know, producing pollution or lawnmowers or, you know, all that stuff that's in our atmosphere. And the other side of it, Laura, is one of the only ways we can actually measure how well our atmosphere is doing is from space. It's really hard to do from St. Cloud, Minnesota. Like, it's really hard to measure the world's atmosphere from there. But once you put a satellite up that goes around the world 15 times a day or 16, like the space station, suddenly you can actually measure all the gases in the atmosphere and how it's changing over time. So it's the right trade-off to be making. We wouldn't want to launch for space 40 million times, but we don't and we won't. So I think the there's a kernel of truth in what you're asking, that we need to think about the effect on our atmosphere of the decisions that we make. But to just focus on space launches is way out of proportion to everything else that we do.
Let's go to JD in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hello, JD.
Hello, Mr. Norrie. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I have two questions for Commander Chris.
All righty.
One of them is, when are they going to have artificial gravity on the space station? And the second question is, for the really large space junk, how much lead time does the space station have so they can maneuver out of the way of the path of the large space junk?
Yeah, two good questions, JD. Artificial gravity, we don't know what causes gravity, JD. We can measure it, but, you know, we only discovered the electron, you know, the little thing that we manipulate in order to harness electricity. We only discovered the electron 120 years ago. You know, there are people that are almost 120 years old, like one long human lifetime. But we do not know what particle or subatomic particle is associated with gravity. So the only way that we can have artificial gravity right now is just to spin something, like maybe a ride at the fair where you get spun so fast, you get pinned against the wall. But that's a really inefficient way. It takes a lot of metal and machinery to spin something. So, but there's an experiment on the top of the space station that is actually looking at subatomic particles and collecting them from the universe. And maybe we will answer the gravity question there. So the answer to your first question is, I don't know. We don't know yet. The second one, lead time for orbital debris. We track tens of thousands. When I say we, NORAD, the Space Force, but also private companies like LEO Labs, they track thousands and thousands of bits of debris that are orbiting the world. And when one of them is going to come close to something of value, another satellite or the space station, then we let the person know, and then they can fire the little thrusters or move and get out of the way. And when I was commanding the spaceship, the space station, you know, once every so often, maybe a year would go by where we didn't have to get out of the way of something, or maybe a few times a year, we'd just to be safe, we'd fire the thrusters to make sure there was no way that we were going to hit one of those bigger pieces.
Geosynchronous orbit, Chris, is about 22,200 plus miles to keep a satellite going around the planet. And the ISS is only 200 plus miles above the planet. Is it constantly being changed so it doesn't drop?
Yeah, the closer you get into the atmosphere, the more bits of the atmosphere there are. There's not like some moment where suddenly there's no atmosphere. It tails off. And so at the altitude where the space station is, it's close enough to the Earth that it's easy for us to go up there, you know, and resupply it and take mm-hmm. food up and take people up and back and forth. But it's far enough away that it has not too much drag. But it's sort of like the weight of a penny. It's like that much drag slowing the space station down. But it weighs, you know, 500,000 tons. So it's got a lot of inertia. But you're right. Every so often, that tiny little bit of drag of running into the molecules of oxygen up there, it slows it down. And so its orbit decays. And so every so often, every, you know, two or three times a year, we fire engines on the space station just to raise it back up, you know, a few more miles. But if we did nothing and we just left the space station derelict, over the decades, it would slowly decay, and it would decay faster and faster as the air got thicker and thicker, till eventually it would burn up. And that's what happened to America's first space station, to Skylab.
That's right.
But we don't want it to hit somebody, so we would rather do that on purpose and put it into the empty parts of the Pacific or somewhere.
China had one that came down too, didn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, most of the spacefaring nations have at some point. And China recently had a rocket body that did that. And fortunately, it landed in an uninhabited, most of the world's uninhabited. We sort of don't think of it that way, but it is. 70% of the world is water, you know. So the odds are it'll hit water somewhere. But the odds are also that it might hit, you know, L.A. So we need to be thoughtful about it. And when we eventually retire the International Space Station, we will want to deliberately fire its engines so that it'll go indefinitely into an empty part of the world as it burns up.
Chris, was there ever a moment up in space where it got so emotional because of what was going on, what you saw, and just thinking about things? Did it get very emotional at all?
Emotions run closer. That's a really good question, George. Emotions run closer to the surface up there because it's such a full and new human experience. You find yourself laughing way easier. You find yourself crying way easier. I found myself more inspired because I was having new thoughts all the time because it wasn't the same thing every day. You know, way out on the fringe of the human experience is often where you think of new ideas. And so, yeah, emotions run high up there. You want to choose astronauts that aren't like super emotional or demonstrative people.
Yeah.
You know, you got, it's just a little group, and you can't have someone who's all super hyper all the time.
Right.
But it's a place where deep friendships are formed, and where you really start to think about some of the fundamental questions for sure.
I was a friend of Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14, and he just went through a profound thing when he was up in space. It was just
yeah, he sure did. I only met Ed a few times. I wasn't a close friend at all, but yeah, he was one of the real deep thinkers about space flight, as is Rusty Schweiker and,
yep,
and some of the guys who are not just technically really good, but also thinking about some of the other things in life.
Joe, Long Island, New York. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah, I have two questions for Chris. First would be, if you composed, I guess, songs and records while you were up there, but, you know, as far as writing this novel while you were there, would you have wanted your mind to go there? You know, Edgar Allan Poe stuff, disaster stuff. Would that have been not a good thing at that time? And then my second question, this happened to me where I worked at a higher level elevation. Didn't really have problem. I was there several months. Didn't really have problems with spatial orientation there. Came back to Long Island, where I am, where it's close to sea level, and everything looked eerily unfamiliar, which was, I did not anticipate that, and the only explanation was I was at, you know, elevation 5,000 feet for 4 months, and then came back. So I'm worried, I wonder if you had something like that, being an, you know, extended stay in
cool,
on the station, yeah.
So, those are two cool questions, Joe. The first one about when you're thinking about a plot like in the Apollo murders, where there's death and bad activity and bad actors, you know, do you want to be thinking about something like that? What does it do to your mind? Do you want to write a book like that on board a spaceship? I find my mind is always running on multiple tracks, and I'm thinking about a bunch of different stuff. And I try and very much live in the moment and pay attention to what's happening right now. But then later, I sort of go back and think about, you know, what might have been, or what did somebody say, or what, you know, how might things have rolled out. And in my mind, it's pretty clear the difference between reality and fantasy. And so I have that deep trove of memories to draw on when I'm writing a fiction like the Apollo murders or this, the next in the series that I'm writing now. And no, it didn't bug me at all. You do. We have psychiatrists and psychologists and crew support people all the time to make sure that we stay mentally healthy when we're up there. And some of the early cosmonauts just went crazy back in the 70s. There's a book called Diary of a Cosmonaut, where it's a descent into madness because they had lousy support from Earth, from Moscow. So yeah, it's something we've learned from. We try and do better. And then your second question about, you know, your spatial awareness and your perception after being at a different altitude. Yeah, it's a real factor. When you come back to Earth, obviously your balance system, because you've been weightless in our case, your balance system is completely changed and different, and how your body reacts to that, but also your perspective of things. Like, if you've only ever seen things from sea level, and now for 6 months you've seen them from a million feet up, then when you get back down to sea level, you're going to look at stuff differently. You're going to look at coastlines and how things fit together. You're going to have that bird's eye view in your head all the time. And as a pilot, I find I never really get a good feel for a place until I've flown over it. And then I get an intuitive sense of how all this fits together. So maybe it was a little bit of that you were feeling. And then, of course, just the difference of living. If you're living in Denver at low pressure, a mile above sea level, you know, the air is always thinner. And so just the straight physiological effects of thin air and thick air, you know, that affects you, the organism of your body, in different ways also.
Chris, what would you say has been the most profound aspect of being an astronaut for you?
Understanding our world better, George. I've been around the world 2,650 times. You know, I didn't count it up, but, you know, somebody did the math and told me when I get back. And if Georgia, in the next, you know, we've been talking here for a couple hours. It only takes 90 minutes, 92 minutes on the station to go around the world. So if you and I, while we've been having this conversation, had been floating weightless next to the window of the space station and had seen in that 90 minutes, had seen all the continents of the world and all and the night side and the day side, imagine if we'd done that in the last hour and a half.
Amazing.
And then the next hour and a half, we're going to do it again. And then 16 times a day and do that for months. It suddenly the world becomes one tangible, small place. If you can go around it in an hour and a half, you know, it can't be very big. And we tend to think of it as huge just because of the limitations of our normal lives and transportation. But the life of an astronaut is such that you truly see the whole world as one place and the shared kind of desires of people, no matter what political or religious system they're living in, the commonality of the human experience. And it's wildly imperfect.
It must be wonderful. Chris, come back again. We love you. Chris Hadfield, his book, of course, The Apollo Murders. Back in a moment with astrologer Mark Lerner. So tell us about 2022.